I'm going to start backwards, as it were. Start with, as it turns out, now, and work back to the middle of the 19th century in Ramakrishna, rather than going the other way around, because I thought it might help us get an even clearer idea of why I'm big on this topic, which I hope you'll understand now from the point of view of Hick. But I want to sort of share this from a larger perspective, because this is not just about Hick. Wow. Single most popular book on comparative religions. It's written by Houston Smith. My guess is that if he hasn't spent it, he's a millionaire, because he sold so many copies, even with the lousy royalties that professors get on books. Since his book on religions of the world has sold several million copies, even if he got a paltry sum, he'd be wealthy by my standards. So why is it that his book has been so popular? If you take my class on world religions, you'll read it. And the selection of scriptures that accompanies it in a book by Philip Novak, in a sense, is also strongly influenced by Houston Smith, because Novak was his student, and they're buddies. Novak is on the Marin side of San Francisco Bay, and these days Houston Smith is on the Berkeley side of San Francisco Bay. He doesn't teach at Berkeley anymore because he's gotten quite enfeebled in his old age. I mean, he was born in 1919. And he's in a retirement situation, but his brain is still working as far as I know. The last time I heard him speak, his brain was definitely working, and it wasn't that many years ago. Very, very interesting man. My point is, something about the approach he's taken to talking about world religions has been more successful than the approach anybody else has taken. And his approach is to cut to what he considers to be the heart of all these different religious traditions, and to speak to that, not to the externals, not specifically to rituals or social forms or not whatever, but what is it that this religion is attempting to do? Or to use Hick's language, where Hick talks about moving people from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness with a capital R. Okay. Houston Smith speaks to how does this religion do it? How does that work in Islam? How does it work in Buddhism? And to a certain extent, he does that as a scholar. To a certain extent, he does that as somebody who's practiced these religions. But if you asked him how he does it, I'm pretty sure that what he'd say is, I do it because I've seen into what these religions are about at some deeper level. I don't think he'd say, I've known God personally. He and I are buddies and we have a conversation once or twice a week. I think he'd say, I've seen into what this religion is about. Now, the reason he would say that sort of thing is he studied with a number of religious teachers, one of whom was a Swami in St. Louis, who was in the Ramakrishna order. So he is an intellectual descendant, as well as a spiritual descendant of Ramakrishna, though in the West. This gentleman, Aldous Huxley, was from a very famous academic family in England. He emigrated to the United States. After the Second World War, he published a book called The Perennial Philosophy. And in this book, he was really following on some original thinking done by a much earlier philosopher, very mainstream in the Western canon, called Leibniz, who first proposed the idea, at least in the philosophical sense, of there being a perennial philosophy. By perennial philosophy, he means the underlying truth of religions that Ramakrishna talks about. And why would he be talking about these things in that way? Because when he emigrated, as many British did in the late 1930s, to Hollywood, where there was money. And from the point of view of the British, also good weather and jobs. And he had a lot of friends there. So he emigrated to Hollywood, and there he met a Swami in the Ramakrishna order by the name of Prabhavananda, whose translations we read. These people are then all descendant from Ramakrishna. And Ramakrishna's ideas, though he himself was not literate and never wrote a word, might have been able to do no more than write his own signature. Ramakrishna influenced all these great intellects. Aldous Huxley was one of the great intellectuals of the 20th century. His books were very popular, not just his book on the perennial philosophy, but his books such as Brave New World, which stimulated a lot of thinking in its time. But he wrote this book called Perennial Philosophy, in which he sought to specifically identify concepts in all the different world religions that bore some degree of similarity. It was published in the late 1940s on the heels of World War II, and it was immensely popular. Was it popular because it spoke to a single truth underlying all religions, or was it popular because the world had just come out of the Second World War and was looking for something? I won't try and answer that question. Maybe it was a little bit of both. Maybe it's not just one thing or the other. But through these two people, this idea of a perennial philosophy, originally stemming from Ramakrishna, has been sort of permeating some level of intellectual discourse, at least in the 20th century, possibly in the 21st. I couldn't speak to that as yet. Okay. So, what about this Ramakrishna person? In the readings that I've given you, one of them comes out of a book called Ramakrishna and the Vitality of Hinduism. It's an extremely simplistic and simple book, originally written in the French. But the reason I included it, and it's a good place to begin your readings, is because it talks about Ramakrishna's life in regards to practicing multiple religions in a very straightforward, simple, digestible way. And I start you with that because the next thing I give you to read is a selection from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. And following that selection from Sri Ramakrishna, the Great Master, these two items are accounts of what Ramakrishna had to say by his direct students. So the first one, the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, was compiled by a school teacher in Calcutta who was hanging out with Ramakrishna. And he would go home after their time together and he would make notes about what Ramakrishna had to say. So they're not full dialogues, but they are notes. And when you read this, you'll see that Ramakrishna speaks almost in parables. It's almost like looking at parables in the New Testament. I'm not saying that Ramakrishna was Jesus. I'm saying that they had different ways of teaching, but that there were certain similarities in the way they taught about things, and you'll see this. For corroboration on this issue of Ramakrishna practicing and experiencing the truth of multiple religions, there's also Sri Ramakrishna, the Great Master, by Swami Saradananda, who was one of his direct disciples. So these are all people who were there listening to what he had to say, two different people listening to what he had to say. Saradananda talks about it after the fact, a number of years. M literally took notes and wrote them down when he was there. So, why is this important? Well, if you think about the situation with the Bible, and I'm not going to say that Ramakrishna and Jesus are on the same plane. I'm not going to that conclusion, although some people would say that. It's not where I'm going here. If you think about the Bible and you think about the Gospels, what we know is everything that's in there that can be attributed to Jesus, and it turns out there's not very much, was written down generations. It was first written down generations after Jesus lived. And I'm assuming that Jesus lived. Some people don't even believe that. I'm going to assume that he did. It doesn't make sense to me that he didn't. So all this information that's in the Bible is not current to the time Jesus was alive. It's current to the thinking about Jesus of students, of students, of students, of students of Jesus. So remember the telephone game when you're a kid? Information gets passed from one person to another person to another person, and it subtly changes over time. So we don't know how accurate that information is. And scholars work with it, and they have different opinions on that, but that's not for this class. Same thing with the Buddha. So what about the teachings of the Buddha? Well, after the Buddha died, his disciples wanted to collect his teachings. So they got together and they all said, well, this is what I remember him having said. And actually, if you look into the Buddhist scriptures, you know an authentic scripture because it begins with, "Thus I have heard." At one time, Lord Buddha was in such and such a place talking to such and such people. "Thus I have heard" means I, who is the person recounting this story, was sitting there. I heard him say this. So all the disciples of the Buddha after his death got together, and they all went around essentially in a circle, or however many of them there were. There's supposed to have been a lot of them that gathered in this cave to do this job. I've been in this cave. It's smaller than this room, so how many of there could there have been? According to the stories, there were lots. Maybe they were very small. I don't know. But anyway, thus I have heard at one time. So Ananda would sit there and say, "Well, I remember that when he was in such and such a place, he gave this teaching." And all the rest of them would say, "Yeah, I remember that." Okay, we all remember it. So that's the way it was. He did say that. Yeah, well, he didn't quite say it that way. He just did it. There was a little bit difference. Okay. There was no writing at that time, remember? Okay. So they had to commit these stories to memory, and then they passed them down to their disciples and their disciples and their disciples. Now, that's an interesting process, because what happens if, for example, the Buddha, who is said to have been like the great physician and prescribed the specific medicine appropriate to each individual, prescribed a medicine for Shariputra that was not good medicine for Ananda? Maybe he waited until Ananda wasn't around and said, "Shariputra, you ought to try meditating in this way, and here's something that you need to know about, but don't tell anybody else because they'll get confused." So if everybody has to agree on something, then maybe something really important got left out. Now, I say this because one of the things we know about Ramakrishna is that's exactly what he did. When his monk disciples were around him, he taught in one way. And when the ladies from Calcutta came to visit him, he taught in another way. And when priests of other traditions came to see him, he taught in yet another way. He did not say the same thing to all three. And it's not so much that he contradicted himself in what he had to say about religious truth, but he said different things to different people. So, for example, there was a great Bengali playwright. Bengali was a language that was spoken in Calcutta. There was a great Bengali playwright who was an alcoholic. So Ramakrishna never told him to give up wine. He said, "You're writing great plays, and if you have to drink to write great plays, go ahead and drink. But by the way, what I recommend is that while you're drinking, think about God in the following way." And what ended up happening was that this Bengali playwright became sober. As the playwright says, he became sober as a result of his spiritual practices prescribed by Ramakrishna. But Ramakrishna never said, "Stop drinking." He said, "Whatever it takes to write your great plays, do it. But by the way, do this other thing." But the point is that when other people came to see him, and if they were having issues with alcohol or whatnot, he'd say, "No, stay away from it. Not good for you." You know. So he tailored what he had to teach to the people who came to see him. It wasn't a one-size-fits-all idea. So what we know about him from M is very interesting because of that. Did you have a question? Was that it? Oh, okay. All right. So let's go back to Ramakrishna now. And that's sort of the context for understanding why he's important right into the 21st century. Okay. I mean, if you go to San Francisco State University, you'll find somebody who's in this tradition teaching religious studies, unless he's retired. Which you could have. Okay. So, Ramakrishna was born in 1836. Doesn't go to school. Basically illiterate. Very poor family. Because of family connections, he gets a job as a temple priest. This is very typical in India. His job as a temple priest is to do things like the rituals in the temple. And in India, that means things like offering flowers to the idol, to the image of God in the temple, and reciting chants and prayers and so on and so forth. That was his job. And this was actually not an old temple, but a new temple, for what it's worth, that happened to have been built by a very wealthy lady at the time. So that was his job. So the temple was dedicated to God in female form, a god called Kali, K-A-L-I. Let me write this down here. So in the Western world, we don't have too many feminine god images. We have Mary, and that's about it. But in Asia, they don't have the view that God is only one gender or another gender. Why should God be male but not female? If God's going to be personal, why male? Why not female? Okay. Now, it's not to say that India is not a highly sexist society. It is. But on the philosophical or religious level, the idea that God could only take one form doesn't make any sense. Now, in some Indian religions, the male principle is considered more powerful than the female principle. So you'll see God and goddess as a married couple, Shiva and Parvati, for example. And then when that happens, always it is the case that the male principle is seen as dominant because it's a sexist society. But there are many times in which the image of the female principle or the goddess stands alone and is viewed as very powerful and very dominant. Question? Wasn't there a question? The Bible's pretty sexist, too. Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, so, you know, if you're thinking about things, you somewhat have to separate culture and cultural values from philosophical systems. But we're not going to deal with that right now. We might be dealing with that later on in the course, but not right at this particular point. Okay, so, remember what I said yesterday about the Hindu view of the power of devotion to God as generating religious experiences through the achievement of the state of samadhi, which is one-pointedness. So Ramakrishna, for whatever reason, was so engaged in his own religious practice in this temple outside of Calcutta that he developed this absolute, incredibly intense, loving relationship with God the Mother. Profoundly intense relationship with God the Mother. Passionate as a child to the Mother. So strong that his mind, following on what we learned from Patanjali, became completely focused on God the Mother as God. And early on in his life, he began to have religious experiences, which is to say, he saw her in the same way as I see forest over here. He saw her in the same way as I see David over here. Literally, that was the kind of experience he had. Now, if you look at the Western mystical tradition, if somebody has one or two experiences like that in their life, like they have a vision of Jesus, it's like, whoa, this person is a saint. Very unusual. And if they could survive that experience, I mean, if the church didn't have a problem with that experience, then they were viewed as a saint. I mean, think of Teresa, for example, though, who had many such visions, and she was very unusual. Ramakrishna had visions, living visions of Kali, who talked to him on a weekly basis. It happened all the time to him. He was very, very unusual. Now, in his life, many people considered him crazy because he was just sort of like running around madly talking about, you know, what was happening and singing her praises. And then he would go into what we would call a trance. It was like, zip, okay. We would call it a trance. The Indians called it samadhi because he'd be so focused that he and God became one, non-differentiated in a certain sense of relationship. Now, ultimately, something else happened where he described that his experience of God was non-different between himself and Kali. That's something else that happens in his biography. I don't think we really need to go there. But the point is that his relationship with her was so intense that she talked to him. And what he says is that everything he spoke about in terms of religious life, he spoke about based upon his experience of being in that state of mind or that condition of God intoxication. So he looks at the human condition from the point of view of goddess. That's better than saying looking at the human condition from the point of view of God. Because as soon as I say God, we put a long beard on him. So if I say he looked at the human condition from the point of view of goddess, maybe we'll make more of the point. And so everything he teaches and all these aphorisms or parables or whatever you want to say that we find, he teaches out of his own experience of being in that condition. Now, if we go back to this book on Ramakrishna and the vitality of Hinduism, in the selection that I gave you to read, yeah. Yes. But, and so that gets into an interesting issue. If Kali is the goddess of destruction, how do you have this warm and fuzzy relationship with the goddess of destruction? So one way you could speak to that is to say, in order to grow food, you have to plow the fields, which is you have to undermine what exists for something new to grow. We tend to think of destruction or unraveling or deconstruction mostly in negative terms. But unless you transform what exists into something else, it can't grow into something else. Right? So you could say that the child's body is destroyed moment by moment in order for the child to grow into an adult person. Because if the child's body is not destroyed in his character as being a child, how's it ever going to grow? That's really the natural process. In fact, I mean, if you think about it on a larger scale, it's fall. And what fall means is that the cycle of life in the world is shifting. And in traditional times, the way fall and winter were seen as a death, if you will, a return to sort of a quiescent state. And out of that comes the new growth of spring. So if you don't have the one, you can't have the other. Another way of looking at this is in agricultural societies, and there are people who think that the idea of reincarnation comes out of agricultural societies. Unless you have the grain which reaches a point of ripeness so that it can be harvested and then is cut down, not only do you not have anything to eat, you don't have anything to plant for the next year. There was no Monsanto, right? You had to take some of the grain that you yourself produced and replant it the next year. So the cycle of life has to go through this process of death and rebirth. The seeds have to ripen and they have to be harvested, which requires the cutting of the grain so they can be replanted. If that doesn't happen, there's no life. Does that help? And that's the way they saw things. So that's the way they saw Kali, among other things. That is the way they saw Kali. Anyway, so he develops this relationship which leads to samadhi. And that's where this passage begins. After he had achieved nirvikalpa samadhi, the young priest understood that the gods of the various religions were merely aspects of the absolute, etc., etc. Now there's several kinds of samadhi. One is samadhi with form and the other is samadhi without form. So nirvikalpa samadhi means samadhi without form. And the distinction here is if you have a relationship with an object and you achieve one pointed concentration upon it, all that's in your awareness is that object. But in the Indian view, the real foundation of human existence, what we would call God, is our own consciousness in a subtler form than what's sitting in this room now. Okay? So that doesn't have any form. I mean, think about your own mind. When you reach in to look at your own mind, you might find thoughts, but then there's awareness of thoughts. If I ask you to show me your mind, as Zen teachers might do, if you said, well, this is the stuff that's going on in my mind, this is what I'm thinking, the Zen teacher would say, no, you showed me your thoughts. Show me your mind. And then the answer to that would be, I can't. Because mind has no form, it has no shape. You can't point to it for that reason, and you can't describe it for that reason, yeah.
When you're talking about focusing on something that you don't normally pay attention to, could that be compared to like breathing and blinking? that you don't really think about doing it.
Yeah.
But if you focus on it, then you notice it, and then
yeah.
you just...
Yeah, I think that that's a very good example. And blinking in particular, because... You just blinked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right now I'm just like
yeah, as soon as we say that, we all start blinking. Yeah, because these things are going on all the time, and we don't notice them. So we're actually aware all the time, but how much time do we spend thinking about the fact that we're aware of something? We don't sort of stand back and watch our internal process very much. But we could. It's actually not very hard to do, except we'll get distracted and we'll stop doing it pretty quickly. But it's actually not very hard to do. If I tell you to do it, you'll do it right away. And then you'll get distracted by something, and you won't be doing it anymore. So the basic meditation process, for what it's worth, is doing just that, is stepping back and being aware of what's going on with your own awareness. Then as soon as you get distracted, notice that you're distracted, and then step back to notice what's going on with your own awareness. And just doing that over and over and over and over and over again. How does the golfer become great? How does the opera singer become great? How does the soccer player become great? They practice, 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 practice ad nauseum until they can do whatever it is they need to do as best as is humanly possible. Just do it over and over again. So that's the technique. If you love God, it's easier to do this, Ramakrishna would say. All right, so I'm repeating myself a whole lot, I'm sorry. So, okay. Ramakrishna slides into this state where what he's aware of is not so much the object, which is Kali, but he becomes aware of his own awareness. So he achieves one-pointed focus on his own awareness, which has no form. Right? Just as the mind has no form, awareness has no form, consciousness has no form. I'm using these words interchangeably because in English we don't draw really good distinctions between them. Ramakrishna gets into this state through practice where his attention is totally focused on the fact of his own consciousness and nothing else. That's a formless state of samadhi, technically called nirvikalpa samadhi. Now, why is it important? Remember the distinction that we were making between personal and impersonal forms of God? Okay. Personal forms of God would be like Jesus. Personal forms of God would be like, I don't know, some form of a Buddha. A personal form of God would be like, I don't know, name some Greek god, that's a personal form of God. Zeus, that's a personal form of God. As soon as you are thinking about a personal form of God, you have an image of God which is different than any other image of God. If God to you looks like Zeus, then God can't look like Kali. Right, because Zeus is a him and Kali is a her. They dress differently too. All right. Hmm? Multiple arms? That could be another issue. Indian gods have multiple arms, Greek gods don't. Although some Greek gods have human and animal combination type bodies, so the Greeks were somewhat liberal in that respect. But the point is, if you think about personal God, right, you're immediately limited to a certain form. When that form, that image, and this we here we're following Hick, that image is different than the image associated with any other personal form of God, right? So they're different. And so where does that leave you in your sort of religious life? One image, the other image, this must be true, that one must be false. Or that one's true and this one's false. Take your pick, they can't both be true because they look different. But if your idea of God is impersonal, the impersonal, intangible, shapeless, undefinable, it doesn't matter whether you're a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Christian or a Muslim. The impersonal, undefinable, shapeless, undescribable is equally impersonal, undefinable, shapeless, etc., no matter what. Right? So when Ramakrishna got into that space, what came out of his experience was saying, hey, there are all these different forms of God here in India. Guess what? The scripture says that the source of them is all the same. I've experienced that. That the underlying reality of all that stuff is the same because the underlying reality of all these gods is consciousness. But then what he did was more radical, and this is the point. He took the next step and he said, maybe that's true for religions outside of Hinduism. And so here, the first thing we run into is the story of his practicing Islam. He meets a Muslim. He's very interested in what this guy's doing. He says, teach me about Islam. The guy teaches him about Islam. He initiates him, is the technical term. Teaches him how to practice Muslim prayers, and pop, within a reasonably quick period of time, Ramakrishna is having a vision of Muhammad and is thinking about impersonal God. He doesn't go to the Kali temple. He doesn't want to have anything to do with what's been his life's work for years. Because why? Because he's a Muslim now for that period of time. Then he has an experience and he realizes that Allah, Kali, fundamentally not different. Now, of course, that's not going to fly real well in the conservative Muslim world, but that's Ramakrishna's experience. The same thing happens later in regards to Christianity. So 8 years later, in November 1874, Sri Ramakrishna heard the Bible being read, blah, blah, blah. He has a vision of Jesus. Then he goes on and he has some experiences of Buddha. So at the end of this, there's a summary where he says, I have practiced all religions, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, etc. The source of that is actually in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. So depending upon your interest, you can read all of the passages that I've given you or not. What I've done is I've gone through the whole book, which is about 800 pages or 600 pages, and I pulled out the passages that specifically reference his practice of other religions. I didn't read every page. It wasn't that hard. There are concordances and things like that. You look them up, it tells you what page this is. Somebody else read every page. I mean, I have read large sections of it, but for this class, I didn't read all 800 pages. Oh, there he says something about Muhammad. Tick. We'll photocopy that for the students. Okay. So, on page 33, he talks about the experience of Islam, and it'll seem very similar to you. The main point is that when he was practicing Islam, he didn't go to the Kali temple, and no Muslim would. Which is kind of interesting because he'd spent his life up to that point in the Kali temple, you know, with mad, wild devotion to Kali, and suddenly he's not going there anymore, which is an interesting sign of something. Okay, when we jump to page 112, he gives this interesting example, which is relevant to the way he talks about different religions and their relationship to each other. And it's out of these kinds of examples that this idea of support of the perennial philosophy is drawn from his students who believe this and begin to practice in this way, and then is communicated down through his students to people like Huxley and Houston Smith. Here's something he says. He's speaking to a group of devotees. And this is probably verbatim, because M was pretty good at this. You may say that there are many errors and superstitions in another religion. In other words, my religion is right, that one's wrong. That's what that kind of thing is. I should reply, suppose there are. Every religion has errors. Everyone thinks that his watch alone gives the correct time. Well, I mean, in the 19th century, everybody had these wind-up watches, right? And what did they set their watches to? They set their watches to some other watch, which was a wind-up watch. There are no atomic clocks, right? There was no internet where you could go to time.gov and get the correct time. If there wasn't a government shutdown, you could go to time.gov and get the correct time. So everyone's watch is different because everyone is setting their, you know, so does that mean that people stop using watches? No. So for one person it's noon, and for another person it's 2 minutes after 12, and for a third person it's 5 minutes before 12. They're all going to get to the theater more or less at the same time, and it's not going to be an issue, right? They don't throw their watches away just because they disagree. So Ramakrishna is saying, and this is out of his experience, he comes up with this image, with this idea. So that's interesting. He says, your watch is different than your watch. You throwing your watches away? No. Okay, your religion says this, yeah, it might have some error in it. Your religion says that, yeah, it might have some error in it. Does that mean that religion is false? No, it means that religion is a limited expression in human culture with human language, with human emotion of some underlying reality. Now, again, if we go back to Hick, Hick would say, well, of course, that's the only way we could know anything, but we can't know the underlying reality. Ramakrishna, I'll say this once again, said, no, I experience the underlying reality in my samadhi. That's actually how come I can say that all religions have errors, but it doesn't matter. Not on an intellectual level, the way Hick would say this, or the way Eck would say it, but on the experiential level. And that's where Ramakrishna is different. Then he goes on. It is enough to have yearning for God. So something got lost in there. It is enough to love him and feel attracted to him. He's saying him, but it doesn't really matter. Don't you know that God is the inner guide? He sees the longing of our heart and the yearning of our soul. This is why devotion to God is powerful. Then he gives another example. Suppose a man has several sons. The older boys address him distinctly as Baba or Papa, but the babies can at best call him Ba or Pa. Now, will the father be angry with those who address him in this indistinct way? The father knows that they too are calling him, only they cannot pronounce his name well. All children are the same to the father. Likewise, the devotees call on God alone, though by different names. They call on one person only. God is one, but his names are many. That was actually a pretty radical thing to be saying. God is one, but his names are many. He says this out of his experience, and he uses this very homey metaphor. But if we think on a deeper level about what he's saying, he's also saying that maybe some religions are a bit like saying pa, and other religions are a bit like saying papa, which is to say some are more developed than others. Now, he doesn't go down that line too far, but he's intimating in that direction. But that doesn't make any difference. It doesn't mean that one religion is better than the other. They all work. The child calls dad's name, whether he says pa or papa. Although if you were standing on the outside looking at that, you'd say, well, one child is older and more sophisticated than the other. Right? So you can do those kinds of things with religion, Ramakrishna is saying, and therefore his followers are saying. That doesn't mean that the religions are any the less true. It just means that they're different, like the child. One child different than another. So you can see, I hope, how some of the more sophisticated ideas in the perennial philosophy get drawn out of these very simplistic metaphors. Yeah?
I'm kind of curious how you could have personal then and impersonal God at the same time.
Well, Ramakrishna answers that. On page 191, he says, one can rightly speak of God only after one has seen him. He who has seen God knows really and truly that God has form and that he is formless as well. He has many other aspects that cannot be described. What Ramakrishna is saying here, and this is, I was just about to go there, so we're kind of tuned into each other. What Ramakrishna is saying is it's not so much that God has form or is formless, because God being God, you can't really limit God. How can you limit God? He says this in another place. God doesn't have limits. We have limits. So our mind takes God to have form or not form. Our mind takes God to be personal or impersonal. But God has no limitations. It's us. And it's us as, he doesn't say this, but he does imply this and he would understand this. It's us, actually he does say this in another place. It's us as limited by culture, time, condition, language. And because of that, we look at God in specific ways. Well, again, Hick says the same thing, but Ramakrishna says this someplace too. Hold on. Let me see where he says this. He's very specific about this. Oh, here we go. Truth with a capital T, another word for God. Truth is one, only it is called by different names. So now he's speaking about God in the most abstract as truth or it. So he's not even putting like a gender-based name, he or she, on it, but saying it. Only it is called by different names. All people are seeking the same truth. The variance is due to climate, temperament, and name. Then he uses this example. A lake has many ghats. So in India, the lakes are, in many cases, kind of, they're surrounded by what we would call sort of a walkway. And then there's steps to go down into the lake, because the way people would have, in many cases, get water for their homes, as well as bathe, is they would go down into the lake, whether with a pitcher of water or a jug of water, or to bathe. So there'd be steps that would go down in the lake. Those are called ghats. From one ghat, the Hindus take water in jars and call it jal. From another ghat, the Muslims, that means the Muslims, take water in leather bags and call it pani. Now, this is interesting. Jars and bags, jal and pani. From a third, the Christians take the same thing and call it water. Suppose someone says that the thing is not jal but pani, or that it is not pani but water, or that it is water but that it is not water but jal. It would indeed be ridiculous. But this very thing is at the root of the friction among sects, their misunderstandings and quarrels. This is literally what he's saying. This is why people injure and kill one another and shed blood in the name of religion. But this is not good. Everyone is going toward God. They will all realize him if they have sincerity and longing of heart. In other words, if they have devotion, right? So he's saying all this conflict in the name of religion has nothing to do with God, has nothing to do with what religion is really about. It has to do with the fact that people are limited by their own concept. And because their concept is limited, they think, I'm right, you're wrong. I mean, it's like what's going on in Washington, for crying out loud. I'm right and you're wrong. Instead of like, well, maybe there's a problem here that we all need to get together and solve. It's not like, yeah, you're wrong and I'm not talking to you, right? And I'm not, that's not just one party saying that to the other party. They're all saying it to each other. And all saying, I'm willing to talk, he's not. I'm willing to talk, they're not. I'll compromise, they won't. It's like, when it came to religion historically, that happened all the time, is what Ramakrishna is saying. And how foolish that is, because what's the difference between jal, pani, water? Just different names for the same water. And how foolish this is if you see it from that point of view. Okay, so you gave me the opportunity to go to that particular quotation. Okay. Page 192, Ramakrishna, here it's referenced as the master. Yes, God has form and he is formless too. Further, he is beyond both form and formlessness. No one can limit him. This is the point, form and formlessness. We, if we stretch our mind, can imagine that God has form, or God is formless if we really stretch our mind. And based upon the idea of formlessness, we can say maybe that's common in all religions. Ramakrishna is saying, on his own experience, even that distinction between form and formlessness is a human conceptual limitation on what the truth is. And the only way to know the actual truth, even behind that, is through direct experience. Okay. So, yes?
There's a scripture in the Bible that says, I don't know if it says directly, but it says basically, if you were to look upon God or any of his angels, your eyes would burn out.
Yes.
Does that mean that our minds can't possibly comprehend its form or formlessness?
Yes. I think that's exactly what it means. And in fact, let me wrap it this way, especially because I'm not going to be able to talk with this lawnmower out here. You think that they could get all the lawns mowed on Saturday and Sunday. Anyway, yes, there are many instances of people saying that they've had religious experience that was so overwhelming that they were incapacitated, that their hair stood on end, that their hair turned white, and this kind of thing. So, and many religious experiences are terrifying. If you look at some of the visions that prophets report in the Old Testament, it's like, I don't think I'd want to see that. You know, people talk about, you know, angels like, oh, fuzzy and warm. But in the Old Testament, angels carry swords that have flames, and they destroy cities. They're not always fuzzy and warm. I wouldn't want to be seeing one of them. That would be a little scarifying. Okay, tomorrow we will finish up with Ramakrishna, and then I'm going to jump into a little bit to introduce the Dalai Lama and his point of view. Okay? If you have questions, bring them. If you have the opportunity to do some more reading, do it.